The J-Talk Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. Ben Maxwell and Sam Robson with you. And Sam, finally something for Samurai Blue fans to smile about on Tuesday evening. It was a far from a vintage performance, but when only 3 points would do, they scraped a 2-1 victory over Australia at Saitama Stadium.
Yeah, it was slightly better. And yeah, the 3 points at this stage, I guess, are all that matters. And I'm just relieved that we're not sat here at the start of the Kenta Hasegawa era of Japanese football.
Yes, so we'll talk about Japan's two games and whether Tuesday night's win was enough to keep Hajime Moriyasu in his job through the next international break in November, as well as rounding up the Levain Cup semi-finals and looking ahead a bit to the next batch of J1 games as the season enters the final stretch. But before all of that, let's welcome in our guest, fresh from a triumphant return to live TV airways from the sidelines at Saitama Stadium and seemingly fresh from his first haircut in about 18 months. It's Scott McIntyre. Scott, Otsukare Summer Des. How are you?
Yes. Very good, thank you. Can you have airwaves on the TV?
Well, apparently, yes, I've heard that. Mm. Yes, it's a rumor going around. Yes.
There we go. Yeah, thanks, Ben. It's good to be back on. Back on the podcast. I disagree with your take that it was good news for Japanese football fans, and certainly I did have a few beers outside of the station, and then a couple more on the train. I'll tell you with a couple of fans, and they were in unison that they didn't think it was a particularly good result. So we'll get into it. I mean, the result has kept Moriyasu in a job, which I don't know on the balance if that is a good thing, but we can get into it.
Yes, indeed. And, you had kept it fairly well under wraps. So well done to the powers that be at Channel 10 Sport in Australia who got our man back in the big time. And so, yeah, Scott, we briefly chatted about it in the green room, but is this likely to be the start of a relationship moving forward?
Oh, I don't know, Ben. I was just happy to be there for the game and be back around the team. Some familiar. You know, I used to spend a lot of time with, particularly that the Australian team. So yeah, still got a lot of friends in the playing group, in the backroom staff, and the coaching staff, and all that. So yeah, it was just good to be there, have a chance to catch up with a few of them the day before the game, the day of the game, and then after the game as well. It was good. You know, it was good. It's been around the atmosphere. This was the first time Australia have played in front of a crowd, I think, in almost 2 years. Mm-hmm. So, it was something different for the players and the coaches, and it was good. It was good to be there. It was only, I think, 10,000 plus this weird 5,000 allocation for the vaccinated seats, which was some kind of experiment, I think, if it went off all right last night. They're looking to implement in the baseball and the J-League, apparently, going forward. So that's could be a curious development. But, yeah, it was good because it looked probably on TV, I imagine, maybe even bigger than it was, because most of those fans were in the backstand with the camera's face. And it certainly sounded good when you were there.
Yeah, that's absolutely brilliant. And, special shout-out to the Australian fans in the crowd, especially the person who had the Take Us Back to Kaiserslautern sign. That was much appreciated. Unfortunately, though, Australia could not replicate the result from 2006. But, we'll come on to that ever so shortly. But, once again, Scott, terrific to hear that you were back on live TV and back, as you say, enjoying all the atmosphere from the sidelines. That's absolutely sensational. Not so sensational, of course, though, was Japan's performance away in Saudi Arabia last Thursday local time, kicked off early Friday morning Japan time. Japan failed to take their chances in the first half, and an errant back pass from Gaku Shibasaki let in Saudi sub Faris Al-Buraikan, who strode in on Shuichi Gonda and slotted home the only goal of the game in the 71st minute. Sam, that's about all I had about this game in my notes. I think we probably want to move off it fairly swiftly, but you're safe to say it was, again, another underwhelming performance for Japan, and we wondered, I guess, as we woke up in Japan on Friday morning, whether Hajime Moriyasu might be on the plane back to Japan with the team or whether he might be stuck over in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, I think many people would wish he might have stayed there. It was another miserable display, and it was against a Saudi team that really wasn't that good either. I think they were missing their best two players in Aldosari and Otaif, and Japan's chances really came from errors from the Saudi players that let them in. So in Japan's second half, it was just a travesty. The back pass pretty much summed up the last few months under Moriyasu, and I think we were hopeful, but I don't think it was ever likely it was going to go between games. But yeah, it did set up this thing where there were strong rumours that if they didn't beat Japan, Moriyasu was gone. But yeah, he just about pulled the rabbit out of the hat, I suppose.
Yes, indeed. So on the same day, Scott, Australia beat Oman 3-1, also over in the Middle East. So heading into this game, I don't know if you caught it, but your Asian game co-host Paul Williams did a video that was spliced into two parts with Ben Mabley for the J Sports soccer feed late last week, and I greatly appreciated them doing that. It was a very enjoyable conversation. I mean, along the lines of what I said last week, it was basically Australia's best chance to win on Japanese soil in a World Cup qualifier, and obviously the result from Friday morning further enhanced Australia's chances. So coming in, again, we're trying to move off the Saudi Arabia game, so coming into Tuesday night, yeah, how were you feeling about this Australian team and how they would be able to perform, you know, as coming into this game and on top of the group?
Just wrapping up what Sam touched on the end there, from what I understand, they weren't rumours. If they hadn't have won last night, he was gone. Some of the names that had been floated about in the press, my understanding was that they were never serious considerations. And from what I know and believe, it was probably likely that Sorimachi himself was going to take over, caretaker capacity, at least for the November games. And then, of course, it's a weird thing because usually it's November through to March, but now we've got these games in the January, February window as well, with a plan being then to try and get someone in for that window. So, yeah, might be revisiting this discussion a month from now after the next round of games. But Australia have done, I think, better than expected, both in terms of, certainly in terms of the points, Italian, perhaps in terms of the performances as well, bearing in mind that two of the three games were nominal home games. They haven't been at home. They haven't played in front of a crowd. They haven't been at home for a long time. they've become something of an Asian Pacific Iraq on this tour of various venues. So having to play a home match against, not a great China side, but still it's difficult. You play that in Doha, you win, and then you follow that up with, a cow paddock surface in Vietnam. You get the win there, and then you have to play again at home. So two of the six home games, the five home games in the group, have already been played in the Middle East, and we still don't know the situation with the next round of matches where they're scheduled to play at home. I think it might be in Sydney, but that's still to be determined. So even, a couple of weeks out from your next World Cup qualifier, you don't know what's going on. So it's a very difficult situation for Australia to have to overcome with a squad of players that I think it's fair to say, far removed from the golden generation. And I've played this experiment with a couple of people. I'll give it to you just quickly. If you were to make a combined 11 from Japan and Australia, how many Socceroos would get into that 11? You don't need to run through the whole thing, but just give me a off the top of your head kind of number.
From the 11 that started for Australia last night, I would have three or four. Three, maybe.
Yeah, right.
Definitely the keeper.
Yeah.
And one
yeah,
of the centre backs. And
yeah, I agree.
Yeah, and yeah.
And I think that's where it ends, yeah.
Possibly, yeah.
Yeah. But it's not very many, is the point, right?
Yeah,
so,
sure.
So, you look at the level where the players are playing at, the experience that they've got at international level, and the basic technical quality as well. So this was a match that Japan should have come into as favourite. It was a close game that probably could have gone either way. Maybe a draw was a better result on the end of the day. But, still Australia are top of the group, and they've come through I think a very, very difficult time. Certainly the most difficult of any a nation in this section, and with a squad that, in all honesty, is probably, you know, I mean, it can be debated whether it's good enough to go to the World Cup. But I think it says a lot about the level of football in Asia. You know, it's which we've been saying on the Asian Game for a long time, is that the mid-tier nations are pushing up. The top-tier nations are perhaps stagnating or maybe even going a bit backwards. And it sees, things are really competitive now in Asian football, which is good. So you asked how did they feel heading into the game? They were confident and they came with the intent to win. I think they played fairly positively and had some good chances. I mean, the chance for Taggart late in the first half, if that goes in, could have really tipped the momentum of the game going into halftime. So, They certainly came here, I think, with the intention of trying to play, trying to pressure Japan and trying to win. Didn't go completely to plan. But still, at the end of the day, they're in one of the automatic qualification spots and Japan are out of it on head-to-head results. I mean, if, you know, things were to end now, it's Saudi and Australia progressing automatically in a month through to the playoffs. So, it is what it is. Australia's World Cup, world record run of whatever it was, 11 straight qualifying victories is probably one that will stand for a very long time, particularly if we go to World Cup every 2 years. It might never be beaten. So, it's not the result that Australia wanted, but it's far from the death knell for their campaign for the World Cup.
Yeah, most definitely. All right, thanks for that, Scott. So from a Japan perspective, heading into Tuesday night, Shibasaki was benched. Perhaps punished for that errant back pass for the must-win game against Australia, who, as I said, came into it as the group leaders, level on 9 points with Saudi Arabia. Daichi Kamada and Takuma Asano were also dropped, with Moriyasu going for three in midfield, bringing in former Kawasaki teammates Ao Tanaka and Hidemasa Morita. Both had very eventful games. And also plumped for Junya Ito on the right of the three behind Yuya Osako. Now, Sam, you will have been very pleased to see Tanaka get the nod to start, I'm sure. And he repaid Moriyasu's faith with the opener in just the 8th minute.
Yeah, I thought he had a generally pretty decent game. He kind of played in the position he was used to at Frontale in that midfield three, kind of the box-to-box. He was pretty much everywhere. He covered a lot of ground. He was always willing to get forward. Obviously, there's a huge slice of luck for some really poor defending that allows the ball to get through to him. But yeah, he finished really well. And generally speaking, I thought he had a decent game. And Morita also came in. I think he was less impressive. He was kind of in... I don't know if he really knew what role he was playing, because Frontale he would want to play in the Endo role. And so he was kind of on that left-hand side. He kind of wanted to stay a bit deeper, but then thought, maybe I should go a bit forward, and just never really seemed to understand exactly what he was doing. But everyone's got on his back about the foul that he has to concede the free kick for the Australia goal. But I think that's really harsh, because... generally speaking, he was pressing, but Japan throughout the entire game didn't really know how to press in an organised fashion. Some people would go, some people wouldn't. And on this occasion, and it was on the occasion a few times where he and Nagatomo would push really high, but nobody else would follow him. So that just leaves a massive gap in behind. So that was what it was. Morita was then sprinting back to kind of try and atone for the lack of the spacing behind him. And yeah, committed a foul, but I think his teammates kind of threw him under the bus a little bit by not helping out and they're engaging in the press. But yeah, generally speaking, it was I think it was an improvement on Shibasaki, who'd had three really poor games. But and then the other selection you mentioned, Ito, I thought he was very lively. He genuinely is. He causes a lot of problems. Maybe he's not as technically gifted as you'd say a Kubo or a Doan in there, just in terms of the intricate passing, the kind of typical way that Japan plays, intricate, coming into it, he gives something different. He's more dynamic, more direct, and I think Japan do need that sort of player.
Matt, have I given my Junya Ito take on here before or not?
I don't know.
I'm not sure. I was just going to ask I was just going to ask you about Furuhashi, though, Scott. I mean, I don't think that anyone would argue he's Japan's best and certainly most informed forward at the moment. I mean, Moriyasu just continues to show blind faith in Osako, and he obviously can't fit Furuhashi into his first 11 for whatever reason. But, I mean, yeah, Ito was full of effort, but, yeah, I mean, I felt his delivery was pretty ordinary from him. That first cross towards Minamino, I mean, once I think that set the tone for his entire evening, really. I mean, it's just whether it's Ito who sacrificed or somebody else, but surely Furuhashi has to start both games in November.
Well, Ito is the worst Japanese footballer at an international level I've seen since Kengo Kawamata. He is absolutely a dreadful footballer. He is tactically one of the dumbest, and this is very rare for a Japanese footballer, but he is like a robot. He's quick, he's flashy, and blah, 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 blah. So what? There's 100 people that are like this that Japan can pick and play. But he knows one thing. He gets the ball, he goes down the byline, and he runs as quickly as he can, gets to a certain point, and he crosses. 9 times out of 10, he doesn't even look where he's crossing. He crosses with his head down because it's whatever someone has taught him to do as a child. And I have absolutely no idea what this guy is doing anywhere in and around the national team. And you guys think I'm crazy, right? But I'm telling you, this guy, Shihon Honma at J2 Niigata, it's not even a comparison to Ito. It's night and day who should be in the national team, just if we're comparing these two players than anyone else. And mind you, the other guy that Niigata have got behind him, this young kid Mito, this 19-year-old, he's a better player than Ito. He's an absolutely superb player. No, I'm serious. You're laughing now, but you go and watch the games and you tell me I'm wrong.
Well, no, because, I mean, Honma wasn't getting in the Niigata team, was he? Was he being punished for wanting to move away or something? Or, I mean, he's not going to get picked in the national team squad if he's not playing for his J2 team, though, is he?
Why not? Nagatomo was getting picked. Why not? No, but I'm saying if you've got good players, but this is the part we can get onto the whole Moriyasu thing. But Moriyasu, can you see any universe ever where he would even consider? I don't think he's seen at this game here, this game there. He's at every J1 game going round. So it's an abrogation of his duty to not get out when you've got players like this that have something rare. That players don't have since Furuhashi was coming through at Gifu. I mean, just because you happen to be in J2, it doesn't diminish the qualities that you have. So I'm certainly not in the Junior Ito fan club. But on Furuhashi, my belief is it's a conditioning thing. He's had these knocks. Recently, there was some concern whether he was going to be in the squad or not. So, yeah, from what I heard, the coaching staff in this instance didn't think that he could get through 90 minutes in either game, and that's why you saw him off the bench. But, yeah, I mean, Minamino on the other side is pretty much dreadfully out of form as well. So, well, I mean... You guys think I'm nuts, right? But in 2 years, you come back to me when Honma is in this team and he's okay. He should have been there at this time as well. But for now, he's gone with the players that he knows. He's gone with the players that he trusts. Okay. This is where we're at.
Yeah.
This is how you're going to play. You're not going to get, you know, what happened for the first goal? It was a dreadful mistake from Bates. The second one was a silly, clumsy own goal. The target shot tipped off. So this could have easily been a game that Japan lost.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, the first goal, for me, I mean, it's a bit harsh to criticise Beach, I think. I mean, the Minamino, whether he's shooting or crossing, I mean, the ball's deflected and Beach is, I mean, he's half a second away from getting to the ball before Tanaka. I mean, he just slightly... just doesn't time his sticking his boot out, does he? So, I mean, I don't think that's terrible defending or anything on his part. He was just, yeah, as I say, just a fraction late. You know, he's not going to be tight to Tanaka when, you know, a shot's taken from the other side of the box. But anyway, that's by the by. Scott, you mentioned Adam Taggart's blast in the last 5 minutes of the first half, and I wanted to mention that and give some props to Shuichi Gonda for getting something onto Taggart's shot, because I think we're probably about to rake him over the coals for Australia's second half equaliser. But I mean, Sam, that was a key moment, wasn't it? Gonda getting something on that, because Taggart, of course, of Cerezo Osaka, he looked a certain to score from about 8 yards out.
Yeah, he did. And it was a very good save from Gonda. It was arguably the only thing he did in the game, because previously to that, I think they were bringing a load across and he was just punching randomly back into the danger zone. He was not really in control of anything, but that save was very good. Taggart, who has not quite hit his straps at Cerezo, he's not quite maybe as confident as he might have been maybe a couple of years ago against Suwon. So, he could have done with that. But it was a good save from Gonda. But I watched it earlier today, and Scott's quite happy, I suppose, with the Australian performance. I thought Australia were poor. I didn't think they could cause enough problems to a Japan side that can really be got at, especially in behind the fullbacks. And I thought a lot of the way that Australia played was far too slow. It allowed Japan to get back and be compact, and they didn't create enough chances against a goalkeeper at Gonda who can make mistakes. I just thought, yeah, it was a really disappointing performance, I thought, from both teams, and quite a poor game. And I think the standard, actually, as I've watched the last game against Saudi Arabia as well, I think the three teams are really off the boil at the moment. And it's great for teams like Vietnam that can come up and cause, and Oman that can cause problems, because, yeah, well, as Scott was mentioning earlier, it does look like those three teams at the top, they're not as good as they can be. And it could lead to one or two shocks. We've seen Lebanon and Oman doing well in their respective groups, and so maybe this is the year for one of those. But I thought, yeah, really poor game from both teams, is my opinion.
Mm. Right of reply, Scott, or should we move on?
Yeah, no, I'm absolutely, I agree. It was not, and this has been the theme, as Sam said, right throughout qualification, as I touched on at the start, because the gap is closing. The mid-tier nations are getting stronger, and the ones at the top are treading water at best. So, yeah, things are closer. But, I mean, looking across the two groups, I don't know if we could confidently say of the representatives that we will be sending to Qatar, who, I don't know, perhaps outside of Iran, who has a chance to do anything at the World Cup. And that's, you know, usually there's a lot of optimism from the representatives that Asia generally does tend to send. But, yeah. I agree. This is far removed from Japanese golden generations, far removed from an Australian golden generation, far removed from a Korean golden generation. So, there's issues, and obviously, you know, things come in cycles and whatnot. But yeah, I agree. I think the standard is not improving at the top level as we want. So whilst it's good to see competition within the confederation, there's going to be no confederations, by the way, in about 5 years' time anyway. So how they handle qualification when FIFA rules the global game and does away with confederations is yet to be determined. So let's enjoy the next Asian Cup, because that will probably be the last one that we get to. But you know, we need for now, whilst we still have an Asia, we need Asian representatives to be doing good. And, yeah, I don't know if things are set up for that to be the case next year.
Mm. All right, then. So we'll move on to the goal that got Australia back into this game then, 20 minutes into the second half. We've mentioned it in passing. Yuto Nagatomo was caught up the pitch, and Morita had to cover for him as Australia broke down their right-hand side. Martin Boyle cut the ball back to the edge of the box, and Morita slid in on Aiden Hrustic, a player who I must admit I knew very little about before this game, but I now know he certainly knows how to take a free kick. The referee initially pointed to the penalty spot, but VAR overruled and said that Morita had fouled Hrustic just outside the box. But yes, it made no difference to Hrustic, who smashed a free kick in off the underside of the bar, always a crowd pleaser, to Gonda's side. So, question marks around the way Gonda set up his wall. Stuart Smith was up in arms about this in our line group on Tuesday night. And then, obviously, then to concede the goal to that side, a terrific hit from Hrustic. But, yeah, question marks are plenty about Gonda's play again there, Sam.
Yeah, I think the wall was arguably not set up too well. And the ball, it struck well, as you said, but it's quite close to Gonda. He doesn't get close enough to it. It's just really poor goalkeeping. You've got to set yourself up a lot better than that. If the wall's covering one side, you've got to make sure you're covering properly the other. And, yeah, it looked good. I mean, every time it comes off the crossbar, it does look a good goal. But, yeah, you've got to question a lot about what Gonda's doing and just generally question Japanese goalkeepers. But we've been here for many years.
Yes, indeed. All right. So, 1-1 it was. Then with 20 minutes gone in the second half. Matthew Ryan made some big saves about 10 minutes later. First from Ito, Scott's favourite, and then Wataru Endo's follow-up volley, and then he saved again from the substitute, Takuma Asano, 3 minutes after that. And then Japan finally, got the second goal they so desperately wanted with the 4 minutes left. A long ball over the top by Maya Yoshida was well controlled by Asano. His left-footed shot deflected off his defender. Ryan got fingertips to it as it looped over him, but the ball bounced against the post. And as Aziz Behic attempted to clear, the ball hit his knee and went in. So, yeah, obviously a really frustrating way for Australia to go behind and ultimately to lose this game, Scott. And I guess, yeah, Behic, he's had a pretty rough night at the office, hasn't he? Not a lot he knew about either goal, I would argue. But, he was in the direct vicinity of both the Japanese goals. So unfortunate for him. And, yeah, a disappointing result for Australia, but they dust themselves down and know that if they can get this game to be played in Sydney in November against Saudi Arabia, then they do have a very good chance to go back to the top of the group, and it'll be at the halfway stage, won't it?
Yeah, and then there's, I think, confusion the week after that where the China game is going to be played as well. But, yeah, I mean, like I said, I spoke with, obviously the coach and a few other players after the game, and that was certainly the overriding emotion for them was one of frustration. I mean, they all said that they felt it was a game that they shouldn't have lost, that they didn't deserve to lose. We can debate that, but they felt that it was one that got away from them, unfortunately, at the end. But like you say, it's done now, so yeah, it's on to Saudi and China in this next window, and it's a very strong position to be in. As you said, you beat Saudi and you go back top of the group, and then after that, you've got China and Vietnam in your next couple of games, and I think it's Oman after that. So all games that they would be expecting to win by that point, you might very well be qualified. So yeah, it's disappointing result on the evening, but the bigger picture, things are still in a very strong position.
Yes, most definitely. So, yeah, at full time then, Japan winning 2-1 and moving on to 6 points from their four Group B games. In the other two fixtures, Saudi Arabia stayed perfect with a 3-2 win over China, and Oman stayed ahead of Japan on their head-to-head. They'll also be ahead on the goals scored if that was one of the tiebreakers, with a 3-1 home win over Vietnam. So just before we move on to talk about all of the fixtures in November, Sam, we had a question, or a couple of questions actually, from Gabrielle Anello for this week's episode. One is about the national teams, and Gab asks, did we all expect Australia to start better than Japan in this round of qualifiers? Gab says he expected it from Saudi Arabia, but not from the Socceroos. So from a, you're more of a Japan watcher than an Australia one. Have you been surprised at the start Australia's made to the group?
To a degree, I think it's more how poorly Japan have started it, because I would have gone into this expecting Japan to win their games. Maybe they would have got a draw against Saudi Arabia, would have been fine, but otherwise I'd have expected Japan to have won every other one. Australia, I think, have performed largely as I would have expected. Obviously, as Scott has mentioned, it's a lot more difficult for them to play without having home games. Like, coming into this and knowing that for at least the first half of this this period, you'd say Japan would be the favourites. They'd be about top. Saudi Arabia, not quite a stronger team, but with home advantage, they usually get results there. I followed them for the entirety of the last qualifying period, and it didn't matter how they played. Something happened at the end of every game for Saudi Arabia that got them a victory at home. So I'd have put them at second, Australia third, based only on that home advantage. But yeah, so I don't think Australia have outplayed themselves too much how they've played, but it's just Japan. They've just been so poor. That game against Oman was dreadful. And it, I mean, this is their best performance, but I mean, if this is the best performance, then it's nothing to write home about. And they've got two tricky ties in November. I know that against maybe, arguably at the start, you'd say they were the weakest two, maybe. But, Moriarty's got to get through those games, and I can see him slipping up. And, yeah, we might be revisiting a conversation in November.
It's a little bit curious why the whole future about Moriarty was has seemed to just die down suddenly, because it wasn't it wasn't a stellar performance. The thing for me, I guess, last night was the intensity was different, right? In the first three games they've played, with a real lack of energy, intensity, and not the usual Japan that, you know, we've seen over the years, where they look to, particularly at Asian level, dominate and dictate the tempo of their game. They did that last night, and I agree, maybe Australia allowed them to do it a little bit, but it was almost as if the playing staff also got this energy, because the pressure was real here. I mean, you know, it was in the press every day, so you know, it was not something anyone could avoid. Whether this old cliche of the group playing for the coach or whatnot, but there was something different last night about Japan. You saw also very unusually after the game, Moriyasu went over to the fans and thanked them or whatever, which is something that I'm not a particular fan of coaches doing, but so you know whether the group was galvanized by this or whatnot, but the question is, okay, if you can do it to some degree in one game, why wasn't it there in the three games, and why is it only happening at these points in Moriyasu's tenure when things are really on the line for not just the team but him personally? And Japan have been to 6 World Cups in a row. There's not many nations that have been to 6 World Cups in a row, and just getting there shouldn't be the aim and shouldn't be the ambition any longer. It should be to get there and win it. And I don't think that Moriyasu is the guy that's ever going to win a World Cup for Japan. There are other coaches that were being previously considered that could do that, and there should be coaches that they should be considering now that can still do it. If I was in the JFA, it wouldn't look like it is. But, I can't imagine that Sorimachi is the kind of guy that's going to make these decisions. But if someone was there within the JFA with the right vision that they needed, that this is our target, we want to go to Kato and we want to win the thing, we don't just want to get there, then it's obvious to anyone that Moriyasu is not that guy to take them, then I would still be moving on him now, doing what they can to at least identify the replacement that you want to bring in. But I don't think that the questions that seem to have disappeared after last night probably should have disappeared so quickly.
Do you think that is just a kind of an acceptance from everyone that the JFA aren't going to change? They're not going to be an organisation that's going to make a radical move. They are just going to do kind of what is the easiest option?
Yeah, because it's been run by another conservative guy in Sorimachi. So that's the reality that that they face, and it's why I said last time that I was on almost the bigger issue is what is the ambition of the JFA and the current group of mostly guys that are in that organisation with this 100-year plan. Okay, it's very well laid out and whatnot, but there aren't many countries in the world that have been to 6 consecutive World Cups. So if you're going to a 7th, you shouldn't be going there just happy to compete and hold your own. You should be going there to win. And that's I think that's a big issue for the JFA itself in terms of what their ambition is and the way that they can see it being executed, where they seem historically, but particularly the current guys of the JFA, to be wary of bringing in anyone who's not completely malleable, who can be bent to do things the way that they want to do them. And my reading of it is the way that they want to do things is not with the belief that they're going to Qatar expect or aiming to win the World Cup. And so I think a lot of the problems and a lot of the issues are also or should be coming with a light being shone on the JFA as well.
Do you think there's any likelihood of that changing? I'm just looking ahead to the next World Cup, where obviously the amount of Asian places increases. So on paper, it's a lot more simple for Japan to just kind of coast their way to World Cups. Obviously, they're not doing that at the moment. But do you think if it is like that and where Japan are quite comfortably qualifying for World Cups, do you think the JFA are just going to be quite content with that?
If it's the current guys of the JFA or if it's some more of their mates, because it just seems to be a recycling of characters, then, yeah, I think that is likely to be the reality, unfortunately, because there's yeah, we touched on some of this in the past. It's not just a football thing, because football reflects society. So there's a reluctance across all tiers of Japanese society to seriously bring on board, accept and give an element of control to foreign ideas orchestrated by foreign people. But football is a global game, and this is where, in my opinion, at this point in the cycle, where they need to be. And I know there was a lot of discussion I saw online with possible names, and, you know, someone was seriously suggesting perhaps that Kenta Hasegawa could be coaching Japan. And then the whole Oniki thing obviously has done very well in a league format at Frontale, but without throwing too much shade on him. He certainly hasn't done that in the pressure of cup games, knockout games in the ACL, where he simply hasn't been able to get the same results out of the team as he has in the league. And for me, it's far more instructive to look at those elements of his coaching career, which mirror what he would face if he was in charge of the national team, rather than the league thing where he's got the team week in and week out. So I don't know if there is a viable candidate domestically at the moment who could come in with the belief and the control from the JFA to say, we're going to go and we're going to win the World Cup. So they need a foreign coach. But, it certainly doesn't seem to be that's something that they're looking into at the moment.
Yeah, fair enough. And interesting to hear you say, Scott, that, yeah, your understanding that the Hasegawa rumours in the press were simply just baseless rumours and, not much truth to those. Just a personal story. My desk at school is next to the PE teachers, and he, like me, is a former FC Tokyo season ticket holder, and he doesn't speak English, and my Japanese isn't great, but whenever we chat, we usually just chat about FC Tokyo, and we both didn't know whether to laugh or cry about the prospect of Keigo Higashi in midfield for Japan in November. So it seems like that crisis has been averted, and all Samurai Blues supporters can be grateful for that. But yes, it does appear it's all slightly died down for Moriyasu, and while he's probably still a dead man walking, he most likely will be in charge for Japan's two qualifiers that come up in mid-November. It's away in Vietnam first, the same day that Australia plays that crunch game, hopefully at home, hopefully for them, at home against Saudi Arabia, and China also take on Oman. And then on the 16th, Japan travel to Oman, hoping for revenge after their defeat, of course, in the first game of this qualification phase. China host Australia somewhere, and Vietnam will entertain Saudi Arabia. Potential banana skin there in the, as Scott described it, the cow paddock in Vietnam. We will wait and see. Saudi Arabia have certainly taken care of business up to this point, though. All right, well, yes, we've mentioned Kenta Hasegawa ever so briefly there. His FC Tokyo side did not make it through to the Levain Cup final. We'll segue on to the Levain Cup semi-finals now, gents. The final, which will take place on Saturday, the 30th of October, will be contested between Nagoya Grampus and Cerezo Osaka, after both teams claimed odd goal wins on aggregate in their semi-finals. Cerezo Osaka drew 1-1 away at Urawa last Wednesday night, and then won the tie 2-1 on aggregate thanks to Mutsuki Kato's goal 8 minutes into the second half. He blasted home a finish in off Zion Suzuki's face. And in the other semi-final, Nagoya won the first leg at home 3-1 against FC Tokyo, and were heading out on away goals at 2-0 down in the second leg before Sho Inagaki bundled the ball home at 10 minutes from time, and that was it to seal a 4-3 aggregate victory for Grampus. Now, Sam, it's pretty blunt of me to try and boil down 180 plus minutes of football into just 71 seconds, but after Adailton had scored an away goal for Tokyo in stoppage time of the first leg, they were then caught completely cold, and Mateus struck a superb third for Nagoya on the evening that saw them take a two-goal advantage to the capital. So am I being too simplistic to say those 71 seconds cost FC Tokyo a spot in the final?
No, I don't think so, because it completely changed the outlook of the tie. I mean, yeah, Tokyo, you, with a 2-1 defeat, they go in almost pretty much level terms with the away goals rule. And the way they played on Sunday, they were pretty much in control for most of that game. And you'd have expected them to go through, but the complete lapse in concentration from getting that goal back and just fighting the way back into a result that I don't think they really deserved in that game. I thought Nagoya were the stronger team in that first leg, but yeah, to completely fall asleep and concede as they did, yeah, it, in the end, it may well have cost them the tie, but it certainly kept you busy. Yeah, congratulations on the commentary gigs over the last week or so.
Yeah, thanks very much, mate. I think everyone could probably tell I hadn't done it since the final in January. And obviously, it's something that you need to do, you know, week on week, I think, to become really confident at it. I certainly felt more comfortable on Sunday than I had on Wednesday. It was difficult to do on the computer. It was harder than I expected. But I did thoroughly enjoy it. And Gabriel's asked a question about the Levain Cup. And he actually asked at the end whether I'd be doing the final. And yes, Gab, that's already decided. So whether I'm going to be any good at it, that's up for debate, Gab. But yes, I will be doing the YouTube for the J-League on the final on the 30th of October. Scott, I know you said in the green room that you weren't able to catch either of these games in full because obviously they're not broadcasted on DAZN and certainly not on free-to-air TV in Japan. But the fact that Tokyo missed out on the final after winning it last year, I don't know. I think as painful as it was, especially to lose the advantage on away goals so late in the second leg, I mean, for me, I think, you know, whether Hasegawa ever manages Japan or not, of course, we hope that never going to happen. But, I mean, surely just another final appearance would have just, you know, papered over the cracks of what's been another really disappointing league campaign. I mean, obviously, it looks great if you make it to a final, and heaven forbid if they had have won it. I mean, you know, you obviously want to see your side lift a trophy. But, I mean, you know, we've both spoken passionately about the state of FC Tokyo over the past few years, and you always do it much more eloquently than I do. I always just get myself tied up in knots talking about Tokyo. But for me, I mean, it might just be a good thing because they need to clean out a lot of dead wood and that they really need to buck up their ideas. And for me, this just would have been window dressing, making another final.
Yes, that's right. I mean, they can't just keep signing 35-year-olds for forever, and it's probably going to cost them young Kassif as well next year, who could very well be an international left back for Japan. So that is what it is. But this whole competition is just ridiculous. I mean, Vegalta Sendai and Avispa Fukuoka have both scored more goals in this silly cup than Cerezo have in reaching the final. Indeed, both of these clubs have reached a final of a competition by playing, in essence, two games. But even if you want to be kind and stretch it to four, you've got this just nonsensical group stage of six and then these other stages here, there, and everywhere. And then these teams are parachuted in at the end. They play a couple of games and then they win a title. It's nobody's title. So I don't place really any stock in this competition at all. I mean, it's ridiculous. And they play these games then on international weekends when, you know, the players that maybe could or couldn't contribute to things aren't there to do it anyway. So, I've just got no interest in this cup competition. I mean, in any way, shape or form. And whoever wins it, I couldn't care less. And I can't even remember who won it 2 or 3 years ago because, I mean, the format of it is just absurd. I mean, the idea is great. Let's get a League Cup. And we've talked about it forever. Let's get it. Let's make it a proper League Cup, open up, knock out all the tiers and bumbo and so on. There's ways that it can be done and make it a proper and great competition. But when you're handicapping some teams and parachuting others in, I mean, it's just, I mean, you know, if you put in stars or little things on your shirt where you're winning this, you should have a good look at yourself because, Vegalta Sendai have scored more goals than Cerezo Osaka in this tournament.
Yeah, I mean, just to follow on from your point there, Scott, this was on Sunday. It was FC Tokyo's and Urawa's 12th game in the Levain Cup this season. And while, Nagoya and Cerezo just played the lazy four to make it into the final. So, obviously, it's a huge occasion for both clubs and their supporters. So I'll obviously be trying to make the most of it. As I said, I'll be commentating it. Sam, just before we move on, Scott mentioned, that the fact that these games are played predominantly on the international match days, especially in the latter stages. Thomas Pennington had a question from Patreon about whether the fact that Yuta Nagatomo said, the 35-year-old that Scott mentioned, was not there. I mean, certainly for the first goal in the first leg when Yoichiro Kakitani was able to give Nagoya the lead. Stand-in left back Sordai Hasakawa was caught napping by Mateus, wasn't he? And, obviously you could argue that Nagatomo wouldn't have been bundled off the ball as easily as Hasakawa was. So, I mean, does this pay any impact at all on the fact that Tokyo didn't make it through, do you think, over the two legs?
Well, I don't know if you can say individual cases, but for any tournament that has semi-finals where you'd say their players, a team's best players are away on international duty, conceivably, it's just pretty ridiculous. I mean, yeah, it would have been better, I suppose, in that Hasegawa situation, but, I mean, we've just been talking about the game against Australia where a goal comes from him being out of position up the field. So, yeah, you can't really say one way or the other that Nagatomo changes it. But it is, I think it does seem unfair on an FC Tokyo who are playing without two of their regular back four because of international duty, and other teams just get to play with their full strength side. It's a weird thing for a semi-final of a tournament if it wants to take itself seriously. And it's not like there aren't a few midweek rounds free later in the month where these games could have been played. So, yeah, it just goes another thing to moan about this tournament. But yeah, I think generally speaking, though, Tokyo across the two legs didn't deserve to win. I think Nagoya were rightfully in the final.
Yeah, no, that's fair. Okay, thanks, Sam. I'll just come back to you for Gabs' second question of the episode. He says that, yes, he appreciates it's a single game and anything can happen in it, but the Levain Cup final seems to have a clear favourite in Nagoya Grampus. Will it be the time that they will lift a trophy for the first time in 10 years, and will Massimo Ficcadenti finally get his first piece of silverware in Japan? Keeping in mind, of course, that Cerezo and Nagoya will play in an Emperor's Cup quarterfinal the Wednesday before this final on the Saturday. And, of course, Nagoya will be in ACL knockout stage action. I think that's next midweek, isn't it? Or is that this midweek? No, next midweek.
It's this weekend. Sunday. Yeah, it's this Sunday, and the other potential issue here is they're combining the quarters and the semi to cut down on travel as well. So if they did get through that, then they'll have to stay in Korea.
Oh, yes.
I think it's another 3 days after. So that's going to really impact, obviously, their schedule. And there's going to, at an absolute minimum, I think probably the league game is going to need to be postponed. But that's something to factor in, because, if it's not, they're going to be playing a hell of a lot of football. I think it's like, what have we got, maybe 6 games in 13 days, something like that, if they got through the semis, or 5 in 13. So it's, again, in terms of the lead up to a cup final, it's also rather odd.
Yeah, most definitely. I had that in my notes for the commentary, but yes, not in my podcast notes. So yes, thanks for clarifying that, Scott. Considering all that then, Sam, can we actually make Nagoya the favourite for the Levain Cup final? Because Cerezo will certainly have an easier run of it before then.
Well, it gets weird, doesn't it, where maybe the cup final is the least important game that they're going to be playing, because obviously they want to win in the ACL. In the league, they're still trying to battle to get into the ACL, and you can still get through to that by winning the Emperor's Cup. There's no real prize other than the trophy, of course, for the Levain Cup. So it's interesting to see how their priorities lie going into that Emperor's Cup game, then with the Levain Cup final at the weekend. But even so, I thought Cerezo across the two legs against Urawa were pretty decent. They can be a good side. They've had a poor season, but any team that can line up with Inui, Kiyotaki and Sakamoto behind a striker is going to cause teams issues, and Nagoya's fixture congestion, it's just going to pile up probably a couple more injuries. They managed to do well without Maruyama and Yonemoto for the last couple of games, but you can think that could build up as well. So I think this is quite an even game, actually. Nagoya will definitely go in as favourites, but there's still quite enough about this Cerezo team that can cause them problems.
All right, terrific stuff then. Yeah, so the final is Saturday, October the 30th, as I mentioned. And, Scott, I know you're looking forward to it so much, so we'll make sure we have you on the week before so we can preview that in as much detail as possible. So let's finish off the episode then with a very brief look at what's coming up in the next few weeks in J1. Most teams have 7 games remaining, of course, but Kawasaki, the leaders and defending champions, have 6 games left, and they lead Yokohama F. Marinos, who have 7 left to play, by 12 points. And Scott, we got you on to talk about the international games, but also for all fans of J1 title races, to try and reverse the curse you put on during the last international break. At that time, of course, all the momentum seemed to be with F. Marinos, as they had closed the gap to 4 points, and you now infamously said the title was Yokohama's to lose. Mind you,
and they lost.
Yeah, mind
it.
You.
They went ahead and
well,
lost
Sam and
it,
I, Sam and I didn't argue with you too vehemently on that occasion, because I think we were thinking along similar lines. So yeah, it looks pretty much done now, though, doesn't it?
Well, you would have to think so. I mean, let's say hypothetically, Marinos win that game in hand. They go to 72, closes the gap to 9. You have to win the last game anyway. Closes the gap to 6. Goal difference is probably, if you're winning all of those games, going to be pretty much even. So you need Kawasaki to lose 2 games.
Yes.
And obviously Marinos not to lose any. There are tricky games. Okay, we have to play Reds. Have to play Tosu side that probably out of the running for anything, and maybe can play with Freedom at home. Cerezo, you know, if they've come off success in these cups or whatnot, and then maybe Gamba with plenty to play for as well. So yeah, there's still opportunities and moments for Kawasaki to slip up. They haven't really slipped up for 24 months. So. So it's not something that you'd be wagering on. But certainly it looks, yeah, absolutely, like they go, so you're going to win them. But, you know, maybe slip up in that Reds game, and if Marinos were on a roll winning their games, who knows?
Well, we know they did it at the end of 2019, but unfortunately for us as FC Tokyo supporters, it was a lot to do with our team bottling it as much as F. Marinos storming past us and ultimately winning the league by 6 points. So we got a question from Johnny Nicol, Sam, and I'll also get Scott's thoughts on it after you answer. Johnny wonders if Kawasaki do go on and win the title, should it be considered a better achievement than last year due to the issues they faced, such as big-name departures, injuries, and ACL involvement? It's obviously really difficult to compare 2020 and 2021, but in terms of an achievement, if they do go on to clinch the title, what do you think? Does this one hold a slightly more sway?
Yeah, I think it does, because last year their main competitors everyone dealt with the COVID stuff and the fixture congestion there, but with Yokohama and everyone else in the ACL, they were completely out of the running, you'd say. And so Frontale, their nearest challengers were Gamba, who weren't that great aside. Yeah, they didn't look like they were going to put too much pressure on them. So they've had to deal with some pressure this season. They've had to deal with 2 of their best players leaving in the summer and having to deal with that congestion with the ACL that maybe a Marinos team hasn't had to face. And yeah, they've had such an incredible injury pile-up as well. At one stage a few months ago, they were getting a new injury every game. So yeah, they've had to come through a lot, and especially that period just before we were talking with Scott last time, where Frontale were really kind of on the edge of collapsing. But to have been able to come out of that and to be where they are now, I think that's a really good achievement from the team and Toru Aniki. So, yeah, I would say this is a more impressive title victory than last season.
Yeah, I mean, I take all those points, Sam, and I you know, I'm kind of inclined to agree with you. But, Scott, I mean, I just can't comprehend how they were able to do so much better than everybody else last season. I mean, just to win the league in such a canter and to do it seemingly, you know, in third gear while everybody else was just spinning their wheels. I mean, it was just absolutely phenomenal. And obviously they set so many records that, you know, some of them might never be broken in J1 history. So for me, as a you know, as a collection of games, I think I don't think anybody could ever top what they did last year. But I do appreciate Sam's points on, you know, the hardships that they've had to face this year that perhaps they didn't have to in terms of the ACL, especially last year.
Yeah, I've made my thoughts on last year known repeatedly that last year needs to come with three asterisks and this year needs to come with two, because this is not a normal year either, right? All the, you know, there's no fans around, you've got extra teams, extra games, all this kind of stuff as well. So last year was certainly not a normal year. This year hasn't been a normal year either, but I'm with Sam. I think that, yeah, this year, particularly the other obstacles, because I mean, last year it wasn't a proper season. It was 1 year condensed into half a year, and it's just, yeah, it may be expunged from the record books at some time. I don't know. It wasn't a normal season in any way. This was a little bit more normal compared to that one, and they've overcome a lot of obstacles to get to where they are. But the thing for me now is not just last year, this year, but it's kind of you know, it's era defining. You know, we saw Kashmir at the end of the 90s and then again, whenever it was, you know, in the late 2000s, those two kind of antler sides that are probably held up as being the best in the history of Japanese football. Now, if you're winning four titles in 5 years, it's an unbelievable achievement. So is this kind of generation of Frontale going to go down as the best that we've seen in the youngish history of the J-League? For me, that's probably the bigger discussion.
Well, for me, that's an absolute yes. But I mean, yeah, I can't profess to have been watching the J-League as closely as I do now when Kashima were... well, I mean, they never romped to a title the way that Kawasaki did last year, did they? And you can talk about asterisks, and I appreciate the fact that it was the craziest season in J-League history. But, I mean, you can't... you can't expunge the title, because you can't tell a Kawasaki supporter that the title his side won last year, you know, doesn't count because everybody had to deal with all these hardships. I mean, as I said, the way they dealt with it better than simply anybody else did is, it's just another check in their book, in my eyes, to make them the most, obviously, the most impressive team I've ever seen. And the dynasty to end all dynasties that we've seen so far in the, as you say, the brief history of J1. So, all right, well, yeah, I think we'll leave the run-in there in terms of the title race. But coming on to the weekend's match day 32, there's only seven games to be played, of course, because the games involving the three ACL knockout stage clubs were moved forward to late September. So with Frontale having the weekend off, F. Marinos will look to cut the gap back to 9 points when they host Sapporo in one of the six games on Saturday. That's on the Saturday night. Before that, Kobe have the chance to go 3 points clear of Idle Nagoya in third when they host Fukuoka. Well, there are some huge games in the relegation dogfight. Also on Saturday, bottom club Yokohama FC host Tokushima, who have edged out of the drop zone after two straight wins. And in the only game on Sunday, it's a massive one down in Oita when 18th placed Trinita host Sendai, who are one spot and 1 point below them. So Sam, there's lots on the line at both ends of the table. What's your pick of the weekend?
Yeah, it's difficult. I think my focus is probably going to be at the bottom and the relegation places. And seeing as I can't say to people in Europe to get up on a Sunday morning to watch Oita and Sendai, I'm going to have to go with Yokohama and Tokushima. Kind of last chance saloon for Yokohama. If Tokushima win, what does that take them? 10 points clear of Yokohama from them to get safety. I think Yokohama almost have to run the table, which they kind of could do. They've got good players in there. They look like the strongest team at the moment of those teams, maybe from bottom 6-7 or so. But yeah, they have to beat Tokushima, otherwise I think it's almost curtains for them. So I think that'll be a really exciting game. Yokohama's recent form is good. The way they played against Kashima before the break was, yeah, very good. And the Yokohama derby. But Vortis as well got a decent victory as well before the break. So I think that'll be the most interesting game at the bottom. But yeah, there's a lot riding on most of these games this weekend.
Yeah, what do you reckon, Scott? Will you be venturing out to a game, or is there one that you can recommend to our listeners to check out, a good game for a neutral to watch?
Well, it's a good weekend, isn't it? Because you've got must-win matches. I mean, Marinos need to win against Sapporo, and as Sam said, Yokohama FC need to win as well. I remember last time I was on, I said when you guys scoffed at me that Gamba are not completely out of some kind of issues getting dragged into trouble with relegation, and I stand by that. They've got a very difficult run. So this match against Urawa is also a big one as well, because you've got these other teams in and around that drop zone playing each other. So they take points, they move up. There's another slip up from Gamba and another step closer to being sucked down into what could be really a dramatic last month for them.
Yes, they might get sucked down into the abyss. That is true. Always keenly fought, of course, Reds Gumba games. And, that's at the 3 o'clock on Saturday. So, an interesting one to check out. Yokohama FC Tokushima, as Sam's recommendation, kicks off at 4 o'clock Japan time on the Saturday. So, just the 7 games to ease us back in after the international break. And, we're getting fired up for a few rounds of games before, obviously, the league stops again for the Levain Cup final, firstly, and then the next international break in November. So, all right, guys, well, I think we will leave it there. We'll give our thanks to Johnny, Thomas, and Gabrielle for their questions for this week's episode. But most importantly, Scott, thank you very much for joining us again. Yes, we hope we've reversed the curse and F. Marinos can really take this down to the wire. But as always, it's been an absolute pleasure, and we look forward to catching up with you again soon.
Yeah, nice to be on.
Fantastic. All right, Sam. Great to be back on it. And I'm sure you can't wait for J1 to get up and running again this weekend.
No, I can't. It's a lot more exciting and positive than having to speak about Moriyasu Japan. So, let's push that into the future and get back to some proper football.
All right then, thanks Sam, and that is it for this week's episode of the J-Talk Podcast. Once again, thanks to Johnny, Thomas and Gabrielle for their questions. Thanks to all of our patrons for their ongoing support on Patreon. If you'd like to get involved, please visit patreon.com/JTalkPod. Thanks again to Scott McIntyre, and thanks to you for listening wherever you are. We'll be back next week to round up J1 Match Day 32. Speak to you next week. Bye for now.
Boom, 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 boom.
The J-Talk Podcast. Yosh, 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 yosh.